From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
That was the first time I had heard that term, dope house. I said, what the heck is a dope house? And so in an effort to kind of understand what was going on, I started to report this story. And, you know, I found that what was happening was that the term is in the middle of this major heroin epidemic, and it really was beginning to sweep the country at this point. This is like the early 70s, and part of what was going on, I later came to understand, was after the urban riot, and particularly after the riot in Detroit, you had the beginning of this pullback of resources, mm-hmm. and jobs and, you know, infrastructure.
Vern E. Smith, former Atlanta bureau chief and national correspondent for Newsweek magazine and author of The Jones Men, published by Rosarian Publishing. To become the king, you have to take the crown. It won't be given up lightly. Heroin kingpin Willie McDaniel has been wearing that particular piece of jewelry for decades. A young blood, Lenny Jack think it would look better on his head. When a junkie tells Jax about a big delivery, the young Vietnam vet makes his move. Feeling his empire crumbling, McDaniel puts the word out to find whomever's responsible. The hunt is on, the battle is engaged, and the streets of Detroit, one red with blood. In 1974, Smith took the crime fiction world by storm with his debut novel, The Jones Men. Now, 40 years later, the story is just as fresh today as it was then. The Jones Men was The Wire before there was The Wire. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Jones Men, with author Vern E. Smith, In Black America.
And I kept working on the story because after the story hit, it caused quite a stir in Detroit, and more sources came forth and wanted to talk to me, and so I was still gathering string, trying to in some way expand the story, when I got an offer to write a book on the subject, and it became a novel. And I had, as I said, I had always been interested in fiction writing and creative writing as a young writer, and so it was an opportunity. It was a test, and so I signed a deal and started to work on the book.
Vernon Smith suggested to his editor at Newsweek magazine that they take a look at the devastating impact of heroin on Detroit's urban landscape back in the early 70s. He knew it was a subject that would draw attention, but what he could not have fathomed, that he would turn the essence of his reporting into a novel, The Jones Men, or that sometime after that, a determined producer and Detroit native, Woody King Jr., would convince Smith to write a screenplay based on the book. The Jones Men is a streetwise novel that chronicles the rise and fall of Lenny Jack, a 26-year-old Vietnam veteran and mid-level heroin dealer, itching to knock the powerful Willis McDaniel off his perch as the number one drug kingpin on Detroit's West Side. Born and raised in Natchez, Mississippi, Smith is the graduate of San Francisco State University and the Summer Program for Minority Journalists at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Smith joined Newsweek as a correspondent in 1971 and was assigned to the Detroit Bureau. In 1972, he won a Detroit Press Club Foundation's annual magazine writing award for a Newsweek article entitled Detroit's Heroin Subculture. In 1979, Smith became Atlanta's bureau chief for Newsweek magazine.
The program that I was in at Columbia was really the first program of its type, and it was born out of the riots of the late 1960s, when the Kerner Commission report determined that a big factor in the urban riots that had been pretty routine in America, right, since around 1965 through the late 60s, that a great deal of what had caused this uprising in American cities and frankly caught a lot of people, including a lot of major media, off guard, was the fact that the mainstream media had done a very poor job in informing its readers and viewers about the disparity and how housing and income and all kinds of negative aspects of American life. Mm-hmm. And there came this crisis of needing to have diverse voices to tell America what was going on. And I was one of the young people recruited to this program at Columbia. And my teachers that summer included Pete Steffens, who was the grandson of the great crusading journalist Lincoln Steffens, who wrote that book, that muck-raking masterpiece, The Shame of the Cities, which inspired many young people to go into the journalism profession. And another important person for my life choice at that time was a man named Joe Strickland, mm-hmm. who was a black reporter for the Detroit News. He was one of my advisors in the Columbia Summer Program. And Joe's work had helped break the Algiers motel case.
Right.
Stemming from a wrongful police shooting during the 1967 Detroit riot.
Right.
So I went from sort of being somebody who loved to write and thought at the point of graduating that when I graduated from San Francisco State, I might go south to Los Angeles and try my hand at screenwriting. I had met Rod Serling and had a chance to dialogue with him, and I was kind of really interested in pursuing it as a career. But after the summer program, I became really invested in becoming a journalist and trying to make a difference in helping people understand what was happening in America. And I worked, my first job out of college was as a reporter for the Long Beach Press Telegram in Long Beach, California. And I was there for about a year and a half and started to receive some job offers, one of which came from Newsweek magazine. And I was impressed with Newsweek. The Los Angeles bureau chief at that time was a black man named John Dotson, who was another influential person in my life. And, mm-hmm. and John recruited me to Newsweek, and I was hired, and my first posting was in the Detroit Bureau, and that was in the early 70s, and it was in reporting and learning about my new environment that I came to write my first novel, The Jones Men.
Now, when you were reporting in Detroit, you were reporting, I guess you did a number of stories on that subculture, and which led to the novel that we're going to get to. But what were some of the things that you found out about the drug trade and that subculture that was going on in the Motor City?
Well, you know, it's interesting, John. I had a kind of relationship with Detroit growing up because a lot of my high school buddies would come to Detroit during the summer where they'd work in the auto industry, and
right.
and they made great summer money, and they had relatives that had moved to Detroit in previous decades and were working and doing well at the auto plants, and a lot of guys I went to school with after graduation moved to Detroit.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Motown and all of that. So I had this really, I was really happy to be going to Detroit when I got hired by Newsweek. And not long after I arrived there, you know, I started to listen to the local news and reading mm-hmm. the newspapers. I started to see these stories appearing in the paper about, you know, people being found trussed up and bound and shot to death in something called a dope house.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I had heard that term, dope house. I said, what the heck is a dope house? And so in an effort to kind of understand what was going on, I started to report this story. And, you know, I found that what was happening was that Detroit was in the middle of this major heroin epidemic. And it really was beginning to sweep the country at this point. This is like the early 70s. And part of what was going on, I later came to understand, was after the urban riots, and particularly after the riots in Detroit, you had the beginning of this pullback of resources mm-hmm. and jobs and, you know, infrastructure, the kind of pillars that had made Detroit this economic engine and business capital for most of its existence, was now beginning to kind of peel away.
Right.
And so you had this kind of desperation in the inner cities, and what was left to a lot of young people, a lot of young black men coming up during that time, was the street trade, the drug trade, which was a quick way to make some fast, easy money, and, mm-hmm. and the profits were such that people began to fight over territory, and you know, it was a very brutal and vicious kind of lifestyle that had kind of cropped up. And you know, I started reporting it, got a lot of good sources to talk to me and explain, you know, the relationships, the dynamics of this subculture that had grown up in the midst of Detroit. I came to report this story, and the piece ran in Detroit and Newsweek.
Newsweek. Mm-hmm.
I think it was 72. The Newsweek piece ran, and I kept working on the story because after the story hit, it caused quite a stir in Detroit, and more sources came forth and wanted to talk to me, and so I was still gathering string, trying to in some way expand the story. When mm-hmm. I got an offer to write a book on the subject, and it became a novel. And I had always been interested in fiction writing and creative writing as a young writer. And so it was an opportunity. It was a test. And so I signed a deal and started to work on the book. I did it sort of at nights and on weekends and mm-hmm. on vacations. I was too young and dumb to realize you didn't do that. But who knew? So anyway, I finished the book, and you know, I thought that. It was, at the least, I knew that the material was fascinating, and that the real people that I had encountered and run across and heard about, that they were great inspirations for characters. And so, armed with sort of all of this knowledge, I just kind of sat down and started writing, which is what you always want to have happen when you're trying to create a story out of your imagination. And, you know, I kind of hit the chord, and the characters begin to speak to me. I could kind of hear their voices, and it was one of those things where once the story got underway, I was compelled to keep coming back and keep writing it because I wanted to know what happened next, you know. I wanted to know, you know, because these characters sort of, as I said, they came up out of the reporting, but once the story got launched and they started to rub up against each other, you as a writer, you were sort of like overlooking it and kind of being surprised at what was happening by these characters. And so anybody who knew nothing about it would find the story an interesting and compelling read, too. And I was lucky that that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, no, that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And speaking with Vern E. Smith, former Atlanta bureau chief and national correspondent for Newsweek magazine and author of The Jones Men. Mr. Smith, we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Jones men. And as I spoke to you earlier, it is a compelling story. And in reading the story, as I articulated this morning, that I kind of knew some of these people growing up. And anyone who has grown up in an urban area probably knows some of these people in the book. And I counted just the main characters, or semi-main characters. It's 29 characters. But I would assume the major character, we're talking about Lenny Jack. Then you also got to talk about Willis McDaniel. And then you got to talk about Joe Red. But all of this is probably predicated on Crow. If he would have kept his mouth shut, nothing would have happened.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, one of the interesting things about the way the book is unfolds is that kind of unintended consequence. You know,
exactly.
There's sort of like a domino effect. And you see how it ensnares all of these different characters as the story unfolds. And one of the reasons why I think the book has retained its power over the years is the sense of immediacy. You know, the book sort of grabs you at the first sentence, and it just kind of sucks you in. You know, I've had people that tell me that the way you kind of thumb through a book and you look at it and you started reading, you're maybe sitting at a traffic light.
Right.
He said he started reading like a sentence, and the next thing you know, people are blowing at him because he's gotten so caught up in finishing.
Now, when you began the story, and it's a believable story, you know, someone has passed away, and I guess all the players and hustlers are having a wake in the back part of the funeral home in this person's honor. What made you begin the story that way?
The genesis for the opening chapter came from a little guy that I ran into who was, he was a user. But he knew the scene, and really, this was after the Newsweek story had run, and he had a shoe shine stand near the Free Press building, which is where the Newsweek office was. And
right.
So I would go in there and get my shoes shined, and we shoot the breeze, and you know, we started talking, and he was just a great storyteller. You know how you meet a source who's like funny, and he has that kind of gallows kind of humor. I mean, I credit this brother a lot of the sort of humor that comes out of the dialogue with the characters.
Okay.
This brother was a great inspiration for that because of his kind of a jocular view of that world. I mean, he was, even though it was a tough life, he was not at all full of self-pity, and he had a kind of ironic view and an ironic way of saying things. And one of the anecdotes that he told me about was this wake that a bunch of big dope men had for a recently departed fellow traveler. And he described sort of the scene that I use in the opening chapter. You know, it had such an impact in terms of like giving you an immediate sense of this world. I mean, it kind of plunged you right into this strange subculture right away. And, you know, the approach that I took in writing the book was to not explain a lot, just to sort of plunge the reader in without a lot of signposts. And then you had to sort of hang on to your seat and see where the roller coaster was going to take you. And it occurred to me when I was trying to determine how am I going to open this book, it occurred to me that if I could recreate that scene, reimagine that scene as it was told to me, and put my main characters of Lenny Jack and Joe Red right in the opening there, and kind of set the story up, that you would be hooked. As a reader, I would have got you.
Well, you did a good job, because once you read that first two chapters and you got a gist of who the players, and no pun intended, were, then you're hooked. I mean, and you took everybody on this journey. I was particularly enamored with the way that you intersperse all the characters. It was somewhat like a neighborhood, and you got different factions that live in this house and live in that house across the street or two blocks over. Was that what you were attempting to do? Because it looked like all of them meshed, and everyone, regardless of how big or small they were, they all lived in this world. And at some point, they interacted with each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things, and you know, in later years, this of new fans that have come to the book, and a lot of them reference the HBO series The Wire when they talk about the Jones Man, and I think one of the reasons why people make that relationship is because of what you just said, the difference between the Jones Men and what had been a typical sort of cops and robbers or crooks, cops and criminals group was that the point of view either stayed in one world or the other. You know, it either was a cop story,
right,
or it was a gangster story, and you never sort of cut between the worlds.
Exactly.
And what I did in the Jones Men, in terms of spinning out this cult, the subculture, where you go from like the higher echelons of this industry,
right,
to the lowest ones, and then you sort of see the bodies colliding at these different levels. So it's kind of a window into, just as you say, John, a kind of neighborhood or a bigger universe,
mm-hmm,
that all of these players interconnect, and you see how one inciting kind of incident involves like a great number of people, and as the story kind of unfolds, you know, you see them all, you see the circle kind of tightening, and you see how the relationships kind of enjoying, and you feel this sense of impending doom, right? I mean, you know that there's an explosion building up. I mean,
somewhere.
I could feel it in the writing, as I said, which is one of the reasons why I couldn't wait to get back to the what in those days was the typewriter, to see what, as I say, to see what was going to happen next, and I really was going to end until I got down to like the last three or four chapters.
Really?
And I could see where part of the explosion was going to come, but it was only part of it. And like you said, but then you know that there's another one coming, because the two main characters are still out there. Something is still percolating, you know? And so I think it keeps you guessing, and it keeps you turning the pages, because you must find out what happened. A lot of people tell me that they read the book in one setting, you know, because they can't
put it down.
Find out how it's going to end.
I mean, it's
that music to the ear of a writer. That's what you want to hear, you know.
I mean,
people can't put it down suddenly.
You know, it's captivating, as I had articulated earlier. Once I got almost to the end, and McDaniels and them finally goes to the motel where Lenny Jack and Joe Red had just left, and that's where the stash is located. And, you know, all Bedlam, you know, takes place there. And then you got Boone and everyone else. The police outside, and, you know, Sheriff Thomas and Big Al. And you finally realize that there's two other people out there
you know, what's going to happen to them? So you got to keep reading because, you know, that you know there's a thread out there that has not been cut, snipped, or looped.
So you're trying to,
what a loose end. It's a loose end out there. But I also found it fascinating as you had articulated that, yes, this world in which they live in, but you also had these individuals living on the periphery. You know, they go to the barbecue joint. Then you got these three brothers, you know, hanging out, ready to go to the dope house. They're not integral part of the story, but they intermingle with the individuals who are a part of the story. So I found that all interesting. But to understand that this type of lifestyle and culture, rightly or wrongly, exists, and I think you articulated in an entertaining fashion that, yes, one may not like what goes on in this world and that world, but it is a world that is true and it happens.
Right, right. And it's part of the larger world. I mean, the larger outside forces
right.
shape what happens in that subculture, mm-hmm. and they feed it and they benefit from it. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do was to show that the tentacles that stretch from
right.
you know, the ghetto where the dope houses and all the violence take place, but you see the reach out of suburbia, out to suburbia.
The gated community, which you wrote about.
Yeah. How it's all connected.
At some point.
You know, the book is it's entertaining and it's unsettling,
mm-hmm.
Because one of the writers who wrote a very nice blurb for the back of the new edition that's published by Rosarium Publishing and is now available, I need to say that, online and at bookstores near you starting this week.
Vern E. Smith, former Bureau Chief and National Correspondent for Newsweek Magazine and author of The Jones Men. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions at your future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.